listening to TribePod, a podcast series of interviews of interest to the HR community. It is hosted by Jim Stroud, sponsored by Proactive Talent, and enjoyed by you. Today's episode begins right after this.
Let's face it, we're in a whole new world now. We know that the reactive old way of hiring and the post and pray model is expensive, and it's getting more expensive every year. What Employer Brand does is it is a long-term strategy that will help you get better at hiring faster and at a higher quality.
75% of candidates will research a company before even applying, and 86% of candidates will not work for a company that has a bad or non-existent employer brand. Some of the many benefits of having an effective and strong employer brand include doubling the amount of applicants you get per job post, decreasing your cost per hire by 40%, improving employee retention by 60%, and overall just yield better Glassdoor reviews.
We know that companies with stronger employer brands spend about 10% less overall for talent.
Proactive Talent helps out clients with their employer brand by going in and working with them in several phases to learn more about the culture, the people, what are the important values to each and every employee, and then to share that story and refresh the employer brand or build it from the ground up. The benefits of having an effective employer brand is that you're going to be able to attract the talent that you really want to join your company, and not just people who would be simply applying for whatever requisitions you have out there. They generally love your message, love your culture, and are there to be with you for the long haul.
For more information on Proactive Talent, visit them online at proactivetalent.com or click the link in the podcast description.
Hello, dear listener, and depending on when you're listening, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening. This is another exciting episode of TribePod. And today I have a very special guest for you. Special guest, tell us, who are you and what do you do?
Hi, my name's Francis Pedraza. I'm the CEO of Invisible Technologies.
So Francis and I were talking earlier about all the turmoil in the world today and how that was spilling over into the business world. And in these interesting times, leaders are looking for policies, ways of doing business, wisdom, as you may say, to make their enterprises prosper. Now, Francis had a very interesting take on where today's leaders could get some inspiration of how to manage their companies. Francis, go into that if you would.
Sure. So I'm sure we've all seen the books that they have at the stands at airports, you know, New York Times bestsellers and such. I haven't read one of those in years. I also don't read the news. I read books by dead people almost exclusively. I read the classics. Okay. And I've been reading books by dead people since I was about 12 years old. And not just in the Western tradition, although that's where I started. I started out reading the ancient Greeks and the Romans and medieval scholastics and some of the authors of the Renaissance and Enlightenment. But I've also been reading the classics of the East, everything from the ancient Chinese, Confucius, Mencius, Lao Tzu, Chuang Tzu, the ancient Indian scholars, the Vedas, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, the ancient Japanese, the Norse, whatever I can, Native American ancient, you know, sources, anything I can get my hands on that's old is probably good. And some of your listeners may have heard of the Lindy effect, which was popularized, a concept popularized by Nassim Taleb. But the Lindy effect states that the longer something's been around, the longer it's likely to stay around. It's kind of like inertia for ideas. And that's because of, you know, kind of a Darwinian natural selection. You know, anything that, you know, when you're dead, you don't have a marketing team. And so if people are still reading, you know, Shakespeare, it's probably because Shakespeare is actually good. Not because, you know, there's a whole, marketing industrial complex promoting the plays.
Interesting. So, to your point, if people are still reading it years later, or centuries later, it must be good. Could it also mean that human beings haven't changed in all the existence of time? We're still basically the same kind of people?
Yeah, Great point, Jim. Great point. I think Jeff Bezos said, you know, in a world where everything's changing, you're going to get the most insight from asking the question, what's not changing, and getting very, very clear on what's not changing. Because if you're clear on that, then, you know, you can sort of use that as the foundation. To quote one of the Gospels, you know, you want to build your house on solid ground.
Sure. And to, I guess, meet you quote for quote, there's nothing new under the sun. I think that's Solomon.
Yeah, Ecclesiastes. I love the book of Ecclesiastes. You know, here's the thing. A lot of secular people are turned off by the wisdom in religious texts. You know, that's unfortunate because wisdom is wisdom, you know. There's normally another way of putting it. So to take the book you just quoted from, the book of Ecclesiastes, it's a very complicated book, and it's actually, you know, maybe, I don't know, the earliest nihilistic text I can think of. So if people think that nihilism, you know, is something that happened after Nietzsche, they should read the book of Ecclesiastes. And it's sort of, you know, he says, vanity, vanity, all is vanity, like meaningless, meaningless, all is meaningless. Everything is like a vapor. Everything has a quality of impermanence because everything is changing all the time, and we're mortals, and we're going to die. And so this can have a paralytic effect where, you know, your reaction is, well, what's the point? What's the point of building a company? What's the point of, you know, doing this or doing that? And, you know, that paralytic effect can be actually very negative, or it can actually be the beginning of wisdom, so to speak. You know, it can actually make you say, well, you know, if my life is so short, and I'm really aware of my mortality, and then maybe I should be very, very careful with what I do. Maybe I should be very careful who I spend my time with. Maybe I should be very careful what I build, etc. So I think that you know, you see this in a religious text in the book of Ecclesiastes, but if you want to turn to a secular philosopher saying the same thing, you don't have to look farther than the Stoics. The Stoics had this phrase, memento mori, remember you will die. And when Julius Caesar or some general had just come back from conquering some lands, and they would host a giant celebration, a feast in their honor, and do this big celebration down the streets of Rome and have all the musicians come play, and have a parade, they would have somebody whose job it was to stand right behind them in the parade and whisper into Caesar's ear, memento mori, memento mori, memento mori, remember you will die. And for them, you know, this sort of recognition of mortality was the beginning of wisdom, because you would never become too arrogant. You'd stay focused on what's important.
Yes, definitely. You know, one thing that another example of things staying the same no matter how much they change. On LinkedIn yesterday, I shared an old video from Steve Jobs, and he was talking about how to recruit people. And I was like, wow, okay, it's not like he's an ancient Stoic or anything like that, but his wisdom is traversing time because he's long gone, but his words are still there and people can still learn from his wisdom. And as I listened to that video, I thought, what kind of CEOs would some of the ancient philosophers be like today? I'm going to read a quote to you and then see if you can think of maybe another influential philosopher who could make an interesting CEO. So this is a quote from Marcus Aurelius. He said, when you wake up in the morning, tell yourself the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. They're like this because they can't tell good from evil. What kind of CEO would
hear that? I needed to hear that. Jim, could you send me that quote afterwards? Like, I need to save that, you know? I'm so glad. That was such a gift. I appreciate that. Can you read it one more time?
I will. When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself the people I deal with today would be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. They are like us. Because they can't tell good from evil.
Yeah, I love it.
Sort of dropped off there. There you go. Okay, there you go. I'm sorry.
Oh, yeah. I was saying that I save quotes like this. I view them as like little treasures And my treasure chest is on Notion. I keep a database of these quotes. And I actually have an email list that goes out every day, meditations@invisible.email. It's optional. My discipline is I don't actually check how many people subscribe to it. I don't know. It could be just one. I know at least one other person subscribes. But every morning I send out a quote. And I would the quote you just gave from Aurelius is such a good example. Because I view it as, you know, to quote the Old Testament, man does not live by bread alone. You know, sure. Like you kind of in the same way that you have a diet, a physical diet, like I just came from a workout. You know, I exercise every day. I try to eat meat and veggies and eat clean. And I know that what I put into my body will affect my energy levels. It's very much the same in terms of your information diet. There's just a difference of depth and substance. And when you start your morning off with some wisdom like that, you know, everything goes better. And the Indian word for this is dharma, you know, in the Mahabharata, which is like their Lord of the Rings, it's like their Iliad or their Odyssey. They tried to encode into the story all of the abstract philosophy of the Vedas, but put it into a story that ordinary people would never forget. And it's this story about five brothers who end up conquering the kingdom and losing the kingdom in a game of dice. And then they spend 13 years in exile and they have to go to the top of the Himalayan mountains and the gods give them special gifts. And then they come down and they fight and they win and they bring justice back. And anyways, this is a great story. But at the very end, there's this whole section called the Education of the Dharma King. And the idea was that this dying king teaches the new king everything he's learned about being a CEO. and the idea was that like great kingdoms or great companies are founded, have their house on solid ground. They are based in Dharma. And Dharma was their word for right action. So, you know, we have this Western word truth, but the idea is that, you know, this is truth applied in a day-to-day way. It's very similar to the word wisdom. Wisdom is the application of truth in day-to-day situations. You know, what should I do right now? What should I do right now? And it's a very different understanding of truth in the abstract. It's more of the embodied truth of like, what is Francis here to do? What should Francis do right here and right now? And having an intuitive sense for the answer to that question, being connected to a sense of guidance about what to do next, they call Dharma. And in the Hindu concept, they call it Krishna's flute. So the idea is you make yourself so hollow of pride and of envy and of all of the vices that that the gods can blow through you. And of course, this is very similar to the Judeo-Christian idea of the Holy Spirit. You get yourself to a state of inner purity, and then you are led to right action. And this is, it turns out the ancient Greeks have the same idea. You know, they had a word for it called aristeia, which was going beyond skill or practice or excellence into this place where you can almost make jazz. You're in flow. You're in flow. You're in a creative place, and the muses are inspiring you. And whether you're a poet and the muses are inspiring you to write poetry, or you're a warrior and the muses are inspiring you to go into battle, or whether you're a business person and the muses are inspiring you to come up with a disruptive business model or to manage your team through a recession or whatever it is that you're doing, you're tapping into some deeper inspiration beyond you that is grounded in intuition. Anyways, in all of these wisdom traditions, wherever you look, the ancients are very obsessed with wisdom, which is, I think, a concept that goes beyond truth and is sort of a little bit foreign to the modern vocabulary, but I couldn't think of a more important thing to focus on and start my day with.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. Do you think that some of these desire of to pursue ancient wisdom could translate into a really good company culture?
Yes. I mean, you know, to some extent we're trying it. So I'll give you an example. You know, some of your listeners right now might be quizzical. I'm imagining a sea full of raised eyebrows there on the other end of this recording. and they're going to be like, what is this weird business podcast? Why are we talking about like ancient philosophy? How on earth does this relate to business? And I'll give you an example. It's not my own analysis. This is Peter Thiel's thinking. Peter Thiel studied philosophy at Stanford as an undergraduate, and he was a protege of René Girard, who was a sociologist and philosopher there, a French scholar. And René Girard wrote a number of books, and he had the main concept that he built all of his analysis of society around, he called mimesis. M-I-M-E-S-I-S. And mimesis is basically imitation. So the idea is that humans imitate other humans. So for example, you don't want a red Ferrari because you inherently want a red Ferrari. You want a red Ferrari because I have a red Ferrari. And you don't just want a red Ferrari because I have a red Ferrari. You want a red Ferrari because, you know, society has decided that red Ferraris are status symbols and they're associated with other things that we want. If you have a red Ferrari, it means that you're successful, that you're sexually attractive, etc. So it really has nothing to do with the red Ferrari. It has to do with all these imitative qualities that are mimetic qualities. And you know, his whole analysis was that this is how babies learn. Babies learn from imitating other humans. And most people don't have a fundamental analysis of what is valuable. They have a mimetic analysis. They think the price is the price because that's what other people are willing to pay for it, not because of something inherent. Now Peter Thiel then went on to great success, build PayPal with Elon Musk, and then invest in Facebook and Palantir and many other companies. And you know, he's one of the main things that he's contributed to business philosophy in his writing is this idea that competition is for losers. Don't compete. Focus on defensible advantages. So, you know, you want to, he says, you know, even though capitalism, we think capitalism is about competition, really capitalism is about trying to build a monopoly, a defensible, scalable, profitable monopoly. A good example of this is Facebook. So if you wanted to compete with Facebook and you had, you built a social network that had all the exact same features, would anybody join your new social network? And the answer is no. Why? Because the value of Facebook increases the more users of Facebook there are. If all of your friends are already on Facebook, the utility of the new social network is very low, and it's very hard to motivate all the people to leave Facebook to switch to the new thing. So that is an example of a defensible barrier. Another example of a defensible barrier is Netflix. When Netflix first produced House of Cards, they spent $100 million creating their own content, and it seemed like a really expensive disaster. But the insight was that because House of Cards was popular, if you wanted to start a competitor to Netflix, if you wanted to start a streaming service and you did the same deals for content with Hollywood and you had the same price point, but you had fewer subscribers than Netflix. Let's just say Netflix had spent $100 million on it. And let's just say they had 10 million subscribers. So they spent $10 per subscriber on this piece of content. If you only have 1 million subscribers, and now you have to compete at the same price point with the same service that also has exclusive content, you have to come up with your own house of cards. And then you only have 1 million users though. So Netflix, it only cost them $10 per user to make House of Cards. For you, it's gonna cost $100 per user to make House of Cards. Now you can't compete with Netflix. So Netflix is defensible. It is very hard to compete with it. And so anyways, I could go, there's an amazing book called Seven Powers by Hamilton Helmer that analyzes seven different ways you can build a defensible business model. We could do a defensibility analysis of Tesla, for example, or of Invisible. I can tell you what I think makes my company defensible. But it all comes back to this philosophical point that competition is for losers. And what that ties into for Thiel is actually a moral point, which is which comes from the Old Testament, if you're Jewish, from the Torah, from the Ten Commandments. And in the Ten Commandments, there are all these commandments about don't envy. Don't be jealous. Don't be jealous of your neighbor's wife. Don't be jealous of your neighbor's lands or your neighbor's property. You know, don't compare yourself. Focus on doing what's right, and on doing, you know, on following, you know, your own path. And, you know, it's interesting how the sort of the fundamental principles of business strategy can be derived from the Ten Commandments.
Very true. Wow. That, you get my mind reeling on a lot of different things. It's, for some reason, I'm thinking about Cicero when he said, let your desires be ruled by reason. It'd be unreasonable to try to say, I'm going to try to kill Tesla when Tesla has so much of the market. I mean, unless you're General Motors or something, you have that kind of money to burn. Definitely see your point. Let me throw some statistics at you. 66% of millennials are employed full time. 35% of the U.S. workforce are millennials. Millennials will represent 75% of the global workforce by 2025. Now, whether true or not, millennials tend to have a reputation for being thin-skinned and easily triggered, whether that's true or not. How do you think the ancient wisdom of Stoicism will be received in the workplace today when the workplace by 2025 would be 75% of millennials?
You're asking me to predict how other people are going to react to ancient wisdom. And I would just quote Aurelius back to you, the same quote you said earlier. Like, you know, are the people that Aurelius was talking about likely to appreciate wisdom? Look, the good news is to all the entrepreneurs out there is that you don't have to hire everybody. I certainly don't believe in any form of unjust discrimination whatsoever, but I do believe in discriminating on the basis of wisdom. And wisdom is a quality you can look for in people. And, we have other words for it. For example, humility. There's a line from T.S. Eliot, humility is endless. In an interview process, you can test for humility. If somebody's really humble, that means they're open to learning. They're curious. They approach life with a sense of wonder. When they see something that is valuable and good, they have some ability to like recognize it, and some willingness or openness to learn from it or gain from it. So all of these are forms of wisdom. And when you build a company culture around humility and around wisdom, I think it's a defensible advantage, right? Because you spend less time doing foolish things, less time, wasting time, and more time, following first principles. So a lot of wisdom is about the difference between following the crowd and following first principles. So another, book that is a sort of a modern way of thinking about ancient wisdom is Ray Dalio's book, Principles, and the whole Bridgewater philosophy of principles. I can give you an example of a very simple business principle that seemingly has nothing, ancient or philosophical about it. The principle of ROI. Return on investment. So everybody in Invisible, every partner in Invisible is expected to think in terms of ROI. Everyone is expected to understand the income statement and understand both our revenues and our costs and our cost structure. And so when anybody proposes a new idea, we're very receptive to it, but we expect that it's not just an idea that they're going to give us, and they're not just going to give us a budget estimate. They're going to give us a return estimate. So like, if we spend this money on this idea and we do it, what's the return that we expect? And not just the long-term return, but the payback period. When are we going to get to 1x on our investment? It will be in 6 months or in 12 months. And then when will our investment double or triple or more? And thinking in ROI terms, is an example of first principles thinking. But guess what? You can see it in the ancients. The famous parable in the Gospels where there's there are three servants of a master, and one servant is given, you know, 10 Bitcoin, another servant is given 5 Bitcoin, and another servant is given 1 Bitcoin. And the person who's given 1 Bitcoin sells it, turns it into USD, and puts it under the mattress. And the person who's given, you know, 5 Bitcoin keeps it in Bitcoin and goes through the roller coaster and turns into maybe 10 Bitcoin. And then the person who's given 10 Bitcoin sells it and invests it and starts a new company and makes that company very valuable. And so when the master comes back, you know, ROI management 101, he fires the person who did nothing. And he retains the person who took some, you know, smart risk-adjusted return, but was not fundamentally innovative or generating alpha, was generating beta, was just following the market. But then he really rewards the person who was following first principles, because that person is the person who can ultimately create the most value in the long run. So I think wisdom is a great foundation for a company culture.
Speaking of company culture, I'm wondering, to have that kind of mindset of the good servant who multiplied the profits of the Bitcoin, do you get that from ordinary workers? I know it's certainly possible, but is it more likely to get that kind of mindset when someone has an equity ownership in the workplace?
So at Invisible, we on our website, we say no employees allowed. And we're actually buying back our investors, and we're trying to become 100% partner owned. We call our core team partners. When you're an employee, the mindset is to just do your job and follow instructions and pass some bar, you know, like basically, do the minimum required. But when you own a company, you're always going above and beyond, and you're thinking about what the company's best interests are and what the company's risks and potential rewards are. And it's a very different set of behaviors. So we've tried to put our equity where our mouth is, so to speak. And we want ownership behaviors. So we give people ownership and liquidity. Actually, starting next year, all partners will have liquid stock. And if they leave the company will be able to buy them out after 3 years, so we can keep recycling the equity into the hands of the people at the company. And that should keep our culture meritocratic instead of becoming a gerontocracy where it's like, who owns the company? People who used to work here 10 years ago, people who invested 10 years ago. No, we want the company to be owned by the people at the company, but we expect the people at the company to act like owners.
I imagine that's a great strategy to have, especially in this great resignation era. When people are jumping all over the place from job to job. Now, before you go, tell us a little bit more about your company, Invisible Technologies. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, sure. Invisible makes it easy to delegate work. So our clients will go on Zoom calls with us, and they'll screen share and they'll show us some business process, some repetitive work that they or their team are doing that they don't know how to scale or they don't want to do anymore or they want to automate. And we will take that business process for them, run it, scale it and figure out how to lower prices over time through automation. We combine outsourcing and automation into an end-to-end solution. And it's industry agnostic. So you can use it for literally any process. Insurance companies use it to process claims. Consulting companies use it to extract data points out of resumes. Airlines use it to submit reports to the FAA. Food delivery companies use it to digitize restaurant menus. Real estate companies use it to scrape Zillow and find homes to buy. Use it for any custom process. And unlike traditional outsourcing, which will bill you by the hours, their incentive is to bill as many hours as possible. We bill by the unit, and that allows us to use as many automation tools as possible to figure out how to lower prices over time while increasing our margins.
Interesting. It sounds like a cost-effective and recession-resistant type of business strategy you have there. Very cool.
Yeah, there's some ancient wisdom there, actually. So Henry Ford, you know, about 100 something years ago, Ford was creating a business miracle, because every single year, Ford cars were improving in quality, they were decreasing in costs, But at the same time, Ford revenues were increasing and margins were increasing. But at the same time, Ford employees were getting paid more and working fewer hours. You know, normally these things are in trade-off relationships. They can't all be possible, but they were able to transcend those trade-offs. How? They industrialized manufacturing through a combination of machines and human labor. And so we're doing the same thing. We call it our digital assembly line. We have 1,000 workers in 60 countries around the world, but we use 200 different automation tools at this point. We have our own automation team, and we're trying to create the same dynamic where workers are getting a better, you know, shake. We call it results-based agent pay. So their effective hourly rates going up. Clients are getting a better shake. We're deflationary. We're figuring out how to cut costs. And then we're also trying to grow into this, you know, massive market of like literally every business process in the world.
Another modern spin on ancient wisdom. This has been a very interesting conversation. I really appreciate it. Learning the ancient wisdom being applied to today's workplace. If someone wanted to get on your mailing list for ancient wisdom or just contact you in general, how can they find you online?
They can find me on LinkedIn, Francis Pedraza on LinkedIn. I'm the CEO of Invisible. And if you send me a LinkedIn message with your favorite quote by a dead person, then I can send you instructions for how to join our little meditations group.
Francis Pedraza, thank you again, sir, for being a guest on Tripod. You are appreciated.
Cheers, Jim.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. 1,000 times thank you for listening and subscribing to our podcast. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please send them to us. You can reach us at Tripod, that's TRIBEPOD, @proactivetalent.com. We look forward to hearing from you.